Good afternoon or good morning, listeners of our medical education podcast series. I'm here today with Kieran Walsh, the editorial lead of the BMJ Learning, part of the educational division of the BMJ Group, and asked Kieran if he would mind speaking with me today because he's submitted a quite interesting letter to the journal that got me thinking about some of the issues that we struggle with as medical educators and education researchers. And as is Dr. Walsh's want, the title alone is quite attention-capturing. The title is "This Thorough, Tedious, Expensive, and Disappointing Study... ... Dr. Walsh, I wonder if I can just start off by asking you to tell the listeners a little bit about your activities at the BMJ and specifically what led you to publish this letter.
Good morning, Kevin, and good to talk to you. It's afternoon in London, and thanks very much for inviting me to take part in this interview. I'm really delighted and honoured. I'm a big fan and regular reader of your journal. The letter is about innovations and innovations in medical education, and at BMJ Learning we try to produce innovations as well on a regular basis, and we're a young new department that only really formally came into being about 4 years ago, and the online learning service is only about 6 years old as well, and it's something we've continually added to and innovated as we've gone. But I was reading a book that Seymour Saracen, who's a well-known educationalist, albeit not within the field of medical education. And Saracen is famous, I guess, as being a bit of an outsider. And he's famous for describing innovations and describing the sustainability of innovations and how sometimes that innovations are not sustainable. And he's described how new ideas within education, not specifically within medical education, but new ideas within education attract people who love new ideas and who like excitement and change. And these are the people who are likely to be enthusiastic and to drive change and make a success of change and then ride it up. And inevitably then, by their very nature, they're likely to move on to new ideas and less likely to be interested in ensuring that the now old idea is kind of entrenched in the system of the medical school or postgraduate deanery or whatever that they're working in. Saracen has also spoken about, and I quote, the attributed feelings of superiority held by members and leaders of new settings, the tendency of members of new settings or new innovations to see administrative questioning and skepticism as obstacles, almost moral affronts to them. And he feels that this inevitably can result in certain innovations not being sustainable, sometimes for practical reasons, sometimes for cost-related reasons.
I suppose one of the things that occurred to me is that in some ways, well, I think there are many good reasons for it. The term limits that we put on most of our positions within the health professional education sphere may have the capacity to reinforce that, and that somebody is in a position for 3 or 5 years and moves on to the next position. And so it really is about trying to find some way to make sure that those innovations are sustained rather than changing with each new leadership group. Does Saracen provide any guidance regarding how to avoid the pitfalls that he's highlighting?
He doesn't really. He talks about the educational change efforts promising quality and improvement, but often failing to alter, and once again I'm quoting from him here, failing to alter the fundamental deep structures of schooling that can persistently impede improvement efforts, and also often different components of the system are systematically interrelated, and changing or improving one component on its own is often not enough because it can have unforeseen consequences in other components of the system. Lastly, Saracen is, and this is something I think we'd all praise him for, he's a real champion of teachers and people who provide education, and he says that, and once again a quote, it's virtually impossible to create and sustain over time conditions for productive learning for students when they do not exist for teachers. And I'm sure that's something we'd all agree with.
Absolutely. Certainly, it speaks to the forefront with which faculty development seems to be put and the challenges that remain in trying to sort out those sort of activities. You mentioned in your letter, bringing it back to the medical education sphere more specifically, the difficulties with publishing these sorts of innovations and making them known and getting others excited about them as a way of trying to market them, for lack of a better word, trying to make sure that these new exciting ideas might have some impact. But there seems to be an implicit message too that perhaps that excitement is unfounded until one has demonstrated that it's a sustainable change and something that's going to move forward. With your role at BMJ Learning or some of the other activities, can you give some examples of reasons why you think some of these very exciting and good ideas maybe don't take hold as long as you might hope?
I won't give an example from BMJ Learning, but I'll give an example from another kind of part of medical education, that of medical education assessment. And here I have to declare a conflict of interest because I've recently published a book on cost effectiveness in medical education. And one example that comes to mind is, say if I were to do a study of OSCEs, of objective structured clinical examinations, and say I had a new assessment that had five OSCE stations on it, and I were to compare the OSCE stations having one examiner at them and OSCE stations having two examiners at them. And say I were to say, after having run the study, that two examiners were better than one examiner, i.e. that two examiners resulted in a more reliable and more valid assessment, and thus a more accurate assessment, even though I might demonstrate that two examiners were only marginally better than a single examiner, maybe a few points better on the scale, which would be great, which would be an innovation, which would be definitely a demonstration of an improvement. However, what you've done is you've improved things by a marginal amount, but you've doubled your cost. To look at it from the other end of the scale, what you could do, if you had two examiners in the first place, you could reduce your cost by 50% while reducing the accuracy of the assessment by likely a few percentage points. So it comes down to a kind of a value judgment, really, and balancing the effectiveness or accuracy or validity or reliability of an assessment against its long-term cost and long-term sustainability, I guess.
I've come increasingly to recognize the centrality of that issue, and that we get a lot of papers into the journal where authors make a very compelling argument for the increase of some particular topic in the medical curriculum. And again, whether it's topic A, B, or C, there may be very good arguments that can be put forward. But what seems to be missing from most of those articles is some discussion of this cost-effectiveness issue, and not necessarily recognizing that the curriculum and the educational world in general is a zero-sum game, and adding something in will necessarily precipitate taking something out. And how do we find that right balance?
Yeah, what I would say, which would hopefully be music to the ear of a journal editor, is that it's a ripe area for further research. And I think I mentioned at the very end of the letter, or I may not have, but would it be worthwhile to survey certain articles, maybe improvement reports, 5 years or 10 years on, and find out how many were integrated into the day-to-day, year-to-year curriculum of the medical school, and how many fell by the wayside. And it would be interesting to find out. Having looked at the field of cost-effectiveness in medical education, there's a dearth of material out there. There's very, very little original articles on this area. There's very little systematic reviews, and most of the systematic reviews bemoan the lack of original research in this area. So I think it's exciting territory.
You did mention at the back, at the bottom of your letter, and I think it's a great idea. It has actually prompted some discussion amongst the editorial group about how we can better not only consider the sustainability of some of the things that have been published in the journal, but also your suggestion of sister activity, where the bad ideas, for lack of a better phrase, I think you call them the unbelievably dreadful stuff. How do we make sure that that stuff gets into the journal? And I think one of the things that's often struck me as very challenging is that in educational research settings or educational innovation, we tend, when we're asked about things like conflict of interest, I was glad you mentioned that concept. People ask us specifically about financial conflicts of interest and commercial interests, and it seems a bit different in our domain in that there's some very direct and clear reinforcement for one's career by being able to put forward these articles and say, look how great a job we did. And so there's this conflict of interest in terms of maintaining and succeeding in one's chosen career by being able to publish these innovations, and likely creates an implicit, if not an explicit, tendency to maybe hide some of those things that didn't work out quite well. So one of the things I hope to encourage people to do is to take full recognition of the complexity of the educational environment and share with the readers the things that didn't work nearly as well as one had hoped, as long as you can put it forward in a way that helps people understand the reasons why it may or may not have worked.
Yes, I'm quite sure you're right. I agree with you that a direct financial competing interest is rarely an issue within medical education research in the way that it often can be within clinical research. But I do believe that certain kind of schools of research within medical education, their leaders kind of develop a belief in their methods, and it's natural then that they would try and prove those methods, and it's human nature that they would try and publish studies that do prove them. Certainly an awful lot of work has gone on outside of medical education in the area of publishing or not publishing negative results, and there's a journal on biomedicine, the Journal of Negative Results. And I think from the author's perspective, why do researchers and sponsors and authors sometimes fail to publish negative results? Sometimes they might feel that it's unlikely to alter things if it's a negative result, or unlikely to advance scientific understanding. Sometimes they might feel that publishing negative studies won't advance their careers. Sometimes, from the point of view of journal editors, negative studies may be viewed as more difficult to publish in medical education journals. Also, some researchers might have constraints on their time and might defer work on manuscripts summarizing negative studies and concentrate on the publishing studies. Certainly in clinical medicine, I think there was a systematic review a couple of years ago that showed that articles with negative results were more likely than articles with positive results to be published in journals with a lower impact factor.
Right, and with all of that, I think there is just the reality that as much as one wants to encourage that publication of those results, it does take that additional effort to figure out how to tell the story in a way, or how to use the research findings in a way that makes it clear that one has advanced understanding as a result of a null finding, as opposed to any of the dozens of things that could have led to the negative results. How do we know that it's the one that seems to be the preferred explanation of the authors? With that, I'm going to thank you for your time. I know it's mid-September right now, and it's a particularly busy time for you, so I appreciate you making the effort to speak with us, and I guess I'll go on record publicly saying that these are concerns for us at Medical Education, and in fact, Larry Gruppen, the chair of the Quality and Standards Advisory Group for our journal, has taken many of these issues to his group and is working on providing some advice with respect to how we can try to make sure that these sorts of conflict of interest and sustainability issues are taken into account. So again, this is Kevin Eva from Medical Education. I've been speaking with Kieran Walsh, and hope you've enjoyed the podcast. Kieran, I hope you have a great fall.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Kevin. It's an honor and a pleasure to speak to you.
All the best.